Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. and EU impose more sanctions on Russia for actions in Ukraine. The U.S. Secretary of State speaks with VOA about South Sudan. A call for more U.N. aid to Syrians. And an Auschwitz march highlights worries about anti-Semitism.
My interpretation of never again is never again we should be indifferent.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The United States and European Union have imposed more sanctions against Russia, saying Moscow has failed to fulfill its commitment to work on defusing tensions in eastern Ukraine. The West is accusing Russia of instigating rebellion by pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine with a goal of destabilizing the country. Zlatislav Hoek says U.S. and EU officials warn of additional sanctions if Russia does not abide by the agreement reached in Geneva earlier this month.
The new sanctions target government officials and companies close to Russian President Vladimir Putin. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki says the sanctions also restrict licenses for certain U.S. exports to Russia.
We've consistently felt that there are a range of officials with close ties to President Putin who have supported these illegal acts in Ukraine that we can target here.
British Foreign Minister William Hague accused Russia of fueling bloodshed in eastern Ukraine.
The deplorable shooting today of the mayor of Kharkiv is another sign of the violence being instigated against those who have opted to support a united Ukraine.
In Brussels, representatives of 28 European Union nations met to enact additional sanctions on Moscow for failing to abide by the Geneva Agreement. A spokeswoman for the European Commission, Pia Arenkilde Hansen, said the EU diplomats are also discussing a third wave of sanctions targeting Russian banking, energy, and other key economic sectors.
Here and now, we're in a situation where there is no de-escalation. So we are currently considering additional measures, such as asset freezing and travel bans, to be the appropriate level of response at this point in time.
Analysts say nothing short of crippling economic sanctions can stop Moscow at this time. Freedom House director David Kramer says the current sanctions are too weak.
I think that the sanctions need to be tougher, harder hitting. It needs to be against sectors of the Russian economy. That is going to cause pain, particularly in Europe, less so in the United States. And I think what the list that was released on Monday by the Obama administration indicates a sensitivity to the difficulty of coordinating this with the Europeans. President Obama in Asia has made it clear he wants the U.S. and EU to present a united front.
German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble Monday called on European countries to stand united and firm in the face of the Ukrainian crisis.
The most important reaction is that Europe sticks together. We need, and nobody should underestimate the decisiveness of Europe. We don't want to have any escalation. We want cooperation, but if we are asked for, we stand firm.
In Moscow, President Putin sought to reassure Russian politicians that the country's military will not be hurt by losing long-time cooperation with the Ukrainian military industry. He said Ukrainian military specialists already have been offered jobs in Russia's defense industry.
They will get decent salaries and apartments. You will receive all of the budget money necessary for that. The process has already begun.
Meanwhile, the Russian economy, already faltering before the Ukrainian crisis, appears to be declining further, with its currency at an all-time low, its stock market at a sharp decline, and investors withdrawing lucrative investments from the country's economy. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the U.S. is considering sanctions on people encouraging unrest in South Sudan, where political and sectarian violence has displaced more than 1 million people. In an interview with VOA at the State Department Monday, Mr. Kerry said the Obama administration is very, very closely looking at possible sanctions, although he declined to specify whom the U.S. might target. He said he believes the fighting in South Sudan, which began a dispute over oil, power, and ethnic rivalries, has now become personal. Fighting broke out in mid-December when President Salva Kiir accused his former deputy of attempting a coup. Secretary Kerry told VOA the crisis in South Sudan is a tragedy, especially given how long South Sudan struggled to become an independent nation.
It's very difficult. Clearly, it has become personal. It's also, I think, about other things like revenues, oil, power, and not just related to sectarian violence. I think the sectarian violence has been, to some degree, exploited as a means of pursuing other ends. So I look forward to my conversations when I'm in Addis Ababa and meeting with the leadership there, and I look forward to continuing to work with a number of different parties to see if we can leverage a better outcome. As you know, I appointed a special envoy with President Obama, Don Booth, the ambassador who was in Ethiopia. He's been deeply engaged on the ground. I personally was very, very engaged during the course of the Christmas period this year when the violence broke out. I was almost every day on the telephone with President Kiir, with former Vice President Riek Machar, trying to find a way forward. I talked to the leaders of Uganda, of Ethiopia, elsewhere. And we're going to continue to push. But it may be that sanctions are one of the things that have to take impact. We're evaluating that now.
Wednesday, Secretary Kerry begins a trip to East Africa that will take him to Ethiopia's capital. He'll also visit the Democratic Republic of Congo and Angola during the 7-day trip. Mr. Kerry said the challenges of governance throughout the region are probably as significant today as they have been in a long time. A Middle East analyst says Egypt is seeing the rise of what he calls a new populist fascism that is almost tantamount to the way Jews were treated by the Nazis in Germany. Nizar al-Sayyad, chair of the University of California Berkeley Center for Middle Eastern Studies, says while he is totally against the Muslim Brotherhood, he believes the Egyptian judicial system is completely out of control. This comes after an Egyptian court Monday issued death sentences to 683 men, supporters of the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood. Al-Sayyad tells James Buddy, it seems that many Egyptians are turning a blind eye to what the current government is doing to the Brotherhood.
Let me be very clear here. I am totally against the Muslim Brotherhood. I believe that it is a terrorist organization. There is no doubt in my mind that they should be banned completely from political life in Egypt. Having said that, I think that the Egyptian judicial system is also completely out of control. It's simply an arm of the executive branch, which doesn't even seem to be an executive branch because it simply appears to be totally run by one single individual who has orchestrated the takeover and the removal of the Muslim Brotherhood and is emerging as the only viable presidential candidate and will likely become president in a couple of months.
Professor, you have said that you believe what's happening in Egypt is the rise of what you call the new populist fascism. What does that mean?
Well, you know, I think what is happening in Egypt today is certainly a reaction to what the Muslim Brotherhood did, you know, during its 1 year of power. But at the same time, it seems to be greatly exaggerated reaction. And at the same time, it is also a reaction that clearly shows that the masses are literally being moved by the rhetoric of the armed forces of Egypt.
State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki described this sentencing as unconscionable. What do you make of that?
I fully agree with that statement, but at the same time, I think what is really important to recognize here is that this is not a final judgment. It is being presented as one that can still be contested. It is very, very possible that when Sisi comes to power, which is going to happen in a span of a couple of months, that he will pardon, in a sense, many of these individuals. I actually find that equally dangerous because, in a sense, it is a game that is being played for personal gain, one that will certainly, you know, help him once he becomes president, but will also consolidate the rule of the army over the state more than it already has.
The interesting thing is that when you talk to some Egyptians, they seem to buy into this type of justice that's taking place.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why I'm telling you it's a rise of populist fascism. They are doing that out of fundamental hatred of the Muslim Brotherhood. The problem is not that. The problem is that the larger sentiment that currently exists in Egypt, that everything that would allow Egyptians to get rid of the Muslim Brotherhood, even if it is unfair, is totally legitimate. So in a sense, you can actually say, although the analogy may not really hold very well, that the way Muslim Brotherhood members are being treated by the Egyptian population today is not necessarily very different than the way Jews were being prosecuted by the Nazi regime. Just like the Germans felt, you know, the Jews did supposedly things that did not help the German state back in Nazi times and were willing to turn a blind eye to what Hitler was doing to them. It seems to me that many Egyptians are turning a blind eye to, what the Egyptian government, this current Egyptian government, is actually doing to members of the Muslim Brotherhood, but not only them, but also others.
Nizar Al-Zayed is chair of the University of California Berkeley Center for Middle Eastern Studies. 35 experts on international law and humanitarian issues have signed an open letter calling on the United Nations to do more to deliver aid to millions of people in Syria who desperately need it. VOA's Al Pessin reports from London.
The open letter, published in European newspapers, says the United Nations is too concerned about violating Syria's sovereignty and should do more to force the Damascus government to allow humanitarian aid into the country. The experts say the legal commitment to Syria's sovereignty is outweighed by an international doctrine called the responsibility to protect. The concept is that if states do not protect their citizens from mass killing and other crimes against humanity, the international community has a responsibility to do so. Professor Stephen Chan of the University of London is one of the signatories.
I just think that the humanitarian situation in Syria has become so desperate that the time for legal caution has passed.
The letter acknowledges that taking a more aggressive approach, such as trying to send in relief convoys without permission, could be dangerous. But Professor Chan says armed convoys have been used before in other conflicts. He says it may be time to try that in Syria.
The Syrian government would be taking a huge risk in terms of what little respect it still has if it were to attack a humanitarian convoy.
Chan says the letter writers want to pressure the Syrian government and rebel groups to allow the aid to pass. But he says, more importantly, the United Nations needs to authorize a more aggressive humanitarian approach.
The key objective is the United Nations, but also within the United Nations, pressure on the Security Council, and particularly on countries like Russia, to facilitate what is intended here in our letter very, very much as a humanitarian exercise.
The United Nations says more than 9 million people in Syria are in urgent need of assistance, and 3.5 million of them are in hard-to-reach areas. The authors do not expect one letter to change that, but they hope it will add to the pressure on Syria and its supporters to do something to ease the suffering. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
President Obama is returning to Washington after an 8-day trip that took him to 4 nations in Asia, Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines. Analysts say Mr. Obama was trying to strike a delicate balance between reassuring America's allies while avoiding antagonizing China. Before leaving the Philippines today, Mr. Obama's final public remarks were delivered to American and Filipino troops in a message aimed at maritime tensions in the region.
Deepening our alliance is part of our broader vision for the Asia Pacific. We believe that nations and peoples have the right to live in security and peace and to have their sovereignty and territorial integrity respected. We believe that international law must be upheld, that freedom of navigation must be preserved, and commerce must not be impeded. We believe that disputes must be resolved peacefully and not by intimidation or force.
That was viewed as an oblique reference to China's territorial claims in the East and South China Seas that challenged the claims of some of its Asian neighbors, including Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. In Manila, Mr. Obama said U.S. policy is not aimed at containing China.
We welcome China's peaceful rise. We have a constructive relationship with China. There's enormous trade, enormous business that's done between the United States and China. There are a whole range of issues on the international stage in which cooperation between the U.S. And China are vital. So our goal is not to counter China. Our goal is not to contain China. Our goal is to make sure that international rules and norms are respected.
and that includes in the area of maritime disputes.
An editorial in today's edition of the state-run China Daily said the Obama trip was essentially about Washington's and its allies' unease about a rising China. It said from the joint U.S.-Japan statement to the new U.S.-Philippine defense agreement, it is increasingly obvious that Washington is taking Beijing as an opponent. The editorial said the United States is presenting itself as a security threat to China and warned Washington's best bet lies in collaborating with, not standing against, Beijing before it is too late. John Hart is a visiting fellow at the Australian National University and an analyst of the U.S. presidency. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty, when the trip did reassure America's Asia allies, it did little to advance Sino-U.S. relations.
There was nothing on this visit that strengthened any moves towards engaging China. Most of the emphasis, as it was on Obama's last trip to the Asia-Pacific region, was on containing China. So I wouldn't have thought it had helped much in that respect.
One of the last items and one of the highlights of the trip was signing this 10-year security agreement with the Philippines. And Mr. Obama went out of his way in some of his last public remarks to insist that the goal of the United States is not to counter China. Quote, our goal is not to contain China. Our goal is to make sure international rules and norms are respected. That includes in the area of international disputes. Will China be assuaged by those remarks?
It never is when the concrete manifestation of that policy is an increase in U.S. troops in the Asia-Pacific region. I mean, it's always taken by China as a threat and not as something that is meant to just secure the peace. It was the same when Obama came to Australia in 2012 and announced the U.S. troop rotation in Darwin. China reacted not terribly badly, but with some degree of hostility to that, and they have done so on this occasion as well. But I think the problem is that in terms of the rebalancing of U.S. policy towards the Asia-Pacific region, the issues like the security issues, access to bases, continued lease on bases, troop rotations in the region, they don't raise a great deal of interest or support amongst ordinary people in the region. I think what's more important in terms of some concrete achievements in the rebalancing policy is the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. That was kind of almost off the agenda on this trip. There was no big speech about the TPP, no great announcements. And of course, there's a number of problems with the TPP amongst U.S.'s potential Asia-Pacific partners. And of course, there are a number of people in the region who think that the greatest problem with the Trans-Pacific Partnership is not with Japan or with Singapore or with the other countries in the region. It's with the United States Congress and the likelihood that nothing will happen to the TPP in Congress, at least until after the midterm elections.
I want to pick up on some remarks that Mr. Obama made at the close of his visit to the Philippines. The Associated Press writer says this, yet even as he moved to increase America's military presence in Asia, Mr. Obama pushed back against suggestions that an undercurrent of weakness in his foreign policy has enabled the type of festering crises that have become distractions. Mr. Obama said he's strengthened the U.S. position in the world, even if his tactics, quote, may not always be sexy. And what do you make of his remarks?
Well, you know, I think in a way he's right, but I think the problem with the whole pivot, or as it's now called, the rebalance, is that a rebalance towards the Asia Pacific does suggest, by definition, less of a priority on matters elsewhere. And at the moment, when the world is looking at the trouble spots are in Russia, Ukraine, the Middle East. I think the problem may be in the actual terminology that was used to describe Obama's concern to shore up the American presence in the Asia-Pacific region and to really treat China as its major foreign policy problem. It's not really a rebalance. I mean, the rebalance was applied to the fact that now that the U.S. is out of Iraq and virtually out of Afghanistan, then there would be a greater focus on the Asia-Pacific region. But it doesn't necessarily mean a decline in attention to what's going on in Europe and Central Asia and the Middle East.
John Hart, a visiting fellow at the Australian National University. Paul Hanley, director of the Carnegie Tsinghua Center for Global Policy in Beijing, says the Chinese perceive that Washington is not striking the right balance in the region. He says they view U.S. support of Japan and the Philippines as counterproductive. Hanley says some Chinese experts and policy officials hold a misperception that the United States supports these countries, specific claims which it does not. Hanley says the Chinese have noticed a clearer and stronger policy view about Chinese actions from the Obama administration in recent months, and he calls that needed at this important moment. He says he hopes Beijing also notices the U.S. desire for stronger relations with China and the need to resolve disputes peacefully and avoid escalating tensions.
To really understand what's happening today, take a look at what happened yesterday.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
It's one small step for man.
I have a dream.
The Beatles.
The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Listen to Today in History, weekdays on the Voice of America, following International Edition.
Amid concerns about the rise of extremist parties in Europe, around 10,000 people from around the world took part in a march Monday between the former Nazi death camps of Auschwitz and Birkenau. Many were from Hungary, where a party that refuses to condemn anti-Semitism won 20% of the vote in a recent national election. Jerome Sokolowski has this report for VOA Television.
A Jewish prayer where it was once forbidden, as the marchers set out under the rain and under the sign that bears one of history's most horrible lies, Arbeit macht frei, work makes free. The March of the Living takes place on Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day in Israel, and it has been held every year since 1988. The event stands in opposition to the death marches carried out here by the Nazis. Branko Lustig, who produced the movie Schindler's List, was on one of them. He says he couldn't have imagined this day.
Never. You know, when I was here in the camp, I was just thinking how to survive one more minute.
More than a million people, mostly Jews, were sent to their deaths in gas chambers like this one, though some were forced to live in conditions that few survived. Fanny Gal toured the camp just before the march.
So nations, I can't forget this. It can never happen again.
There were many participants from Hungary, which accounts for one-third of the Jews who died here. Christina Kuhn is also Hungarian, and also one of the many non-Jews who marched.
It's important from the young generation, because in Hungary, it's a big problem, the anti-Semitism.
March organizers want to bring as many young people as possible to Auschwitz to be transformed by the experience of being in the place that has become the symbol of humanity's greatest evil.
Wunderberger Josef.
As the long column finished the 3-kilometer march and arrived at Auschwitz's sister camp, Birkenau,
Ilya Shandor.
Victims' names echoed from the loudspeakers. Another survivor, former Israeli Chief Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, recalled what happened to a man who arrived on a transport and wanted to get his prayer articles.
He jumped into the wagon against the rules. And he brought out with him the Talis and film. They were beating him to death on the spot.
On this spot now, putting on these tefillin is a mitzvah, a good deed. March organizer David Machlis says never again doesn't mean terrible things won't recur.
My interpretation of never again is never again we should be indifferent.
And he hopes that each of the 150,000 people who have been on this march will have learned the dangers of indifference. Jerome Sokolovsky, VOA News, Auschwitz.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.